welcome to another edition of Expanding Minds. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to unpack the connections between cultures and consciousness, including the culture of technology. Lately, I've been reading a lot about systems theory, which can mean many different things to many different people, but has at its core the cybernetic insight that knowledge and arguably the way that we construct reality has a fundamentally circular process. You put in the input, loops around, gets outputted, the output becomes back in as an input. We construct things on the fly. Now, that might sound kind of abstract, but I'm really happy today because we can flesh it out with historical reality through a discussion with Fred Turner, our guest today, who is the author of a book that I just totally love, From Counterculture to Cyberculture, which has been out about 5 years. And it was just an enormous joy when it came out because it did the heavy lifting of fleshing out a connection which other folks had noticed. I'd poked around in it a bit, and anyone paying attention to the 1990s resonance with 1960s psychedelic culture and that sort of Mondo 2000 Wired magazine zone would have contemplated, which is the connections between cybernetics, systems theory, and the emergence of the information age, computer culture, new modes of productivity, digital industry, Apple, Google, the internet, and the peculiar experiments, ideologies, utopian dreams, and social relations we associate with the counterculture. And not the political counterculture so much, but the counterculture devoted to consciousness, to new forms of community, to psycho-spiritual explorations. And these two things seem like they wouldn't go together very well, but Fred in his book and in the work he continues to do, looking at art, culture, technology, and politics in the second half of the 20th century, it's really going to be able to help us clarify that. So Maja will not be joining us this week, unfortunately, so we'll go right in and welcome Fred to the show. Hey, Fred,
hi,
thanks
Eric
for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I've had a really fun day. I hadn't read From Counterculture to Cyberculture in a while, and I was going back through it and finding even more jewels and nuggets of yumminess, and looking over some of your more recent stuff. So it's really a blast. And you know what I kind of was thinking about doing here is that I feel like, you know, in general, there's a tendency for people to kind of, unless they're really into history, even the history of their own moments, not so much, you know, distant history of kings and conquerors, but just the history of our moment, our technological moment, our cultural moment, it sometimes seems a little bit like obscure. Why pay attention to some weird, you know, academic book that came out in the 1950s or some strange experiment that some, you know, engineers did with a mouse in 1958 or whatever? And yet, it seems that the story that you tell in your book and that more largely is shapes your work, it's really incredibly important thing for people to understand, you know. And I think of it as two ways, and so I'm just going to set up these kind of two big ideas and maybe, you know, ask you to help flesh it out or show the way that your work deals with it. One is that something remarkably new and transformative happened, or a whole set of things happened, but they share a lot during and immediately after World War II. That in some sense, the world changed, and it changed technologically, it changed philosophically, it changed politically, it changed culturally, that something or many things happened that have a certain shared quality. There's sort of a bifurcation point in World War II.
Yep.
And that out of that, and here's the second point, you know, we can identify the development of technological civilization, of new forms of command and control, of computers, of, you know, globalization driven by these technological forces. Of course, globalization existed before, but there's something fresh and new about the new media culture, the emergence of a global technological network, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, we have all of these kinds of interesting countercultural stories that, you know, in many ways also come out of World War II. These are the people who become the hippies and the counterculture, you know, are born in this era. They grow up in the 50s. They reject the 50s. And we think of those as very different, contributors to our current moment, when we're still kind of living in a consumer culture that's marked by these some of these countercultural values, but what you're really showing us is how intimately tied together those things are, and how deeply systematic these connections are. And I just think that's a really big deal. I don't know why I think it's a big deal. So
well, thanks. It's you know, it's a counterintuitive deal, and it's certainly not one that I thought I would see. You know, one of the ways my book has been misread, and is a really fascinating kind of misreading. You know, a number of reviewers have said, "Wow, it's great. Turner finally showed us how hippies brought us the personal computer." And in fact, you know, what actually happened historically is that the wild, collaborative, scientific culture that emerged during World War II to help develop weapons dramatically shaped two parallel developments in American culture. One, the rise of information systems, information technology, and systematic related ways of thinking about how we ought to organize our lives. And two, the rise of a kind of individual-centered, collaborative, peer production mode of doing work. And those two things happen simultaneously, and they stay entwined from World War II very much until our own moment. And when you see them as entwined, particularly in the present, you can see how it is that, you know, things that may feel like they're making us very free are in fact constraining us, and how things that are constraining us may in fact be freeing us in other ways. It's a very sort of counterintuitive story.
Yeah, and in a way, at the core of that sort of looping is this new idea of systems that emerges in World War II, when they have technical problems to solve. How do you make an anti-aircraft gun, you know, right, adequately pursue an airplane in flight? Well, you somehow have to figure out a way to let the gun operate on the fly, to take in information about that moving target, put it back in, shoot, oh, you're a little bit off. How do you take in that difference so that you can make the thing respond more directly to the target? And in so doing, with these very practical technological problems, create the platform for a new way of understanding both machines and human beings, which is cybernetics. And and that's really the kind of thing behind these two trends that you're talking about. And I wonder if you could just, I mean, since you've written about it, it's sometimes counterintuitive, sometimes hard to explain, but it's also so basic once you kind of get it. Could you sort of introduce us to the sort of fundamental ideas about how to model both, you know, human beings and machines that emerge in that moment that kind of feed into these trends that you talk about? I mean, give us cybernetics in a little bit of a...
I'll do it in a nutshell to the extent that I can, and I want to tell it in two dimensions. I want to tell it as a theory of human-machine interaction, and I want to tell it as a social, a way of being together, a sort of social ideology. So let's start with the human-machine piece. Norbert Wiener is the hero of this story, and you know, he's someone he's a mathematician, he's a boy genius, and he's doing war-related research at MIT during World War II. And one of his jobs is to figure out how to shoot down enemy airplanes. And what he figures out is you really can't know what direction a plane is going, and you can't plan on that basis. But what you can do is measure and change, measure and change, measure and change. And he realizes that this pattern of measure and change echoes something that he's seen in a totally other context. And it's something that he describes later in a book as what happens when you pick up a pencil. When you pick up a pencil, you make decisions about where the pencil should go, but your body is also sort of getting the feel of the wood on the pencil, getting the feel of its heft, getting feedback from the world at large about where it ought to be. So your hand is moving with an intention from within, but also in response to signals from without. And that's the quintessential model of cybernetic agency. You may have intention, but your attention is shaped by the world around you as you bump into it. And when you bump into it, you receive signals from it, which Wiener calls feedback. Those signals in turn change both your action and your intention, which in turn are changed again by the material world which you encounter and get feedback from. And that process of seeking feedback, going back and forth, that's cybernetic agency, and that's the core principle of cybernetics. It's a vision in which control is managed through communication between material and immaterial things, and in which people act independently and yet somehow together. The second piece I want to tell, so that's the human-machine piece, the sort of pencil-in-hand story. The other piece I want to tell, though, is a story about cybernetics as a social regime. One of the things that happened in World War II that was tremendously important was that under the pressure of the need to develop weapons really quickly, large-scale institutions, mostly state-sponsored and universities like MIT, brought together teams of specialists from lots of different specialties and just smashed them all together and said, guys, we'll give you whatever you need, go figure it out. And that world was a world in which collaboration was something that was hard to do, but you had to do it really fast, and you needed a language through which to collaborate. Cybernetics provided a kind of universal, everyday lingua franca for that community, and it provided a way for people to understand themselves as simultaneously hyper-individual and parts of systems. That understanding, that kind of very collaborative, simultaneously hyper-individualistic and systemic understanding of what it means to be together and work together, has come right down from the 40s to our own time. When you see peer production, when you see open source software, when you see those kinds of collaborations, what you're really seeing is World War II military weapons development collaboration made into a much more widespread social phenomenon. So those two things, cybernetic agency with regard to man and machine, and cybernetic stories for organizing collaborative peer-based production, occur simultaneously and come down through time together.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people listening, you know, just when you were talking about these principles that the scientists were operating under, were probably like flashing on you know, if not their own experience in the workplace or doing, you know, collaborative work with people, just the sort of ideas that have been floating around the internet age and the sort of mind frame of mm-hmm. digital capitalism. But the story you tell then is about how the sort of way that those kinds of styles of collaborating developed is that while they continue to, you know, develop to some degree in the sciences, and in fact, one of the things that seems interesting about cybernetics in the way that it mirrors on the social level, on the actual way that people are coming together, some of its concepts, which is a really interesting thing in itself, that it develops this interdisciplinary language. It's like this robust interdisciplinary language that allows people from sociology, anthropology, computer science, neurology, to all get on more or less the same page. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, those kinds of scientists are coming together and they're meeting and they're doing productions and things like that. So it's a good model for the production of knowledge, but it's also a great way to like make art, make cool parties, maybe like try to redesign your social living space. So talk a little bit about how this very technocratic innovation driven by the exigencies of war migrated into the sort of humanistic and ultimately countercultural frame.
Sure, will do. So we have several stories that we tell ourselves about World War II in the 50s that aren't true. One of the stories that isn't true is that the 50s were a locked down, closed world kind of era. There were ways in which, and places in which that was partly true, but there were also spaces like the military-industrial complex that were actually radically open, really collaborative, hyper-collaborative, open in such a way that they were not only open to scientists, but open to social thinkers, artists, and all those people flowed through and were together. They were open to radically different sexual styles, radically different races. You'd be amazed at the openness of the Cold War military establishment. Simply astonishing to me now. So that's one of the stories. I think the other story is that science and science and the state were sort of on one side of a fence, and the counterculture and the art world were on another side of the fence, and they didn't actually meet. And that's also not true. In fact, they interacted constantly. You know, cybernetics was an idea that was born out of a series of conferences, not only with scientists, but with anthropologists like Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson and other social scientists who were in turn public figures writing very well-regarded public books. Norbert Wiener's first two books on cybernetics, the book Cybernetics and then The Human Use of Human Beings, which came out in 1948 and 1950 respectively, were both bestsellers, despite the fact that the book Cybernetics was about half mathematical equations. And they were bestsellers because they offered people a vision of a society that was deeply collaborative, deeply systemic, in which they could still be individuals. And I think that's really important. That vision traveled into the art world in New York in the late 50s, early 1960s, mostly through the work of John Cage. John Cage had been reading cybernetics, so had a series of performance artists, some associated with a group called USCO, the US Company, where Stuart Brand, who would later found the Whole Earth Catalog, was a participating artist. Those folks had all read cybernetics. They had all begun to imagine that it would make sense to themselves build collaborative, technology-centered spaces in which to be playful that could serve as models of a new kind of community. One other word is really important here. It's actually two words, and they are information and consciousness. For Norbert Wiener, the thing that holds the world together is information. What puts you in conversation with the physical world around you is the fact that it's sending you signals and that you're receiving them through your nerves. And you're sending signals back out to the world by the movements of your body and your mind. According to Wiener, the world is basically a system of information, and our job is to perceive it and work within it. The counterculture, particularly the new communalist wing of the counterculture, took up that idea and transformed it really into the idea of consciousness, that if we could simply find a way to share the proper consciousness, we could build a kind of society that wouldn't be hierarchical, wouldn't be militaristic, but would in fact be collaborative and open, ironically just the way that the military-industrial research complex was. And so in that way, ideas developed to facilitate multidisciplinary collaboration inside wartime laboratories became the basis of communal dreams of multidisciplinary, non-bureaucratic, collaborative, consciousness-centered community. And that fed directly into the counterculture.
Yeah, and one of the interesting shifts that happens there, it's almost like the ideas of information, and then right next to information is the notion of pattern, because if you're trying to trying to actually describe or characterize what is information, how do I compare information to random chaos or what they would call noise, how do I pick that out, and you start to get into a language of pattern. And patterns are, of course, also what allow the different disciplines to talk to each other, so you create something like the idea of a feedback loop where, you know, a system's output becomes its own input after it passes through an environment. You can draw it as a circular process. And I see that circle, like, oh, that's a simple pattern. And then even in different fields, in anthropology, you know, Bateson trying to describe how Alcoholics Anonymous work on the one hand, and somebody else trying to describe how a frog's nervous system responds to a fly in another sense, can both go, oh, there's something circular about this process, or there's something about the way that pattern then functions as a way to jump between different communities, different individuals, different things.
Right.
But those ideas of pattern, like that's also, you just have to move it like one or two steps and it becomes profoundly spiritual and metaphysical. And what's wonderful about this, it makes you be able to look at the often hazy rhetoric of '70s movements and recognize that they're actually doing something more than just going, we're all one, man. They're actually saying, hey, there's a way to be in the world such that more ecological or systematic properties can draw us together. And yes, they enchant it, or they take drugs and they experience it as if they're in a group mind, or the whole party is just like one thing that's happening, and you know, people kind of can dip into those sorts of experiences. But there is a rigor there as well, even if it often looks kind of fuzzy. And some of the artists, like the USCO, is a great example of something that, you know, I didn't know about before I read your book. But they were like doing both. They were reading these guys. They were thinking scientifically. They were using machines. They were using multimedia, all these things that we would recognize now. But they also really much had a this kind of larger mystical sense that there was a deeper pattern that they were discovering, and a kind of group mind working working through them. So what is that? How do you see that idea of kind of taking consciousness in the direction of the kind of group mind or the larger mind or this very hazy idea that you come across in hippie texts and things, but it seems like it's linked to something, you know, pretty more concrete in some ways.
So I'm very drawn to the idea of group mind as a person, as a living person. I love the idea of a kind of diverse, distributed intimacy with others. As a historian, I'm really disturbed by the idea of group mind because the way that it works out on the ground is very different than the ideal, I think. You know, if we go back to the 60s and early 70s, the communes that were formulated around the notion of a group mind and a shared consciousness tended to be racially discriminatory. They tended to be incredibly gender segregated and heteronormative. They tended not to be liberated at all. And one of the things about a turn to group mind as a way of organizing a social world is that it takes away the tools that you have for negotiating explicitly in language the distribution of resources, and it tends to make things a matter of cool. You know, if you're cool enough, if you're in touch with the vibes, you can rule. If you're not, well, you know, sorry, you don't get the bananas today. And so that's been a real challenge. So I'm drawn to the mystical side of the vision as an opportunity to open up to a more leveled, collaborative way of being together and a more intimate way of being together. And I think that's grounded in the leveled, collaborative, intimate way that scientists worked together in the 40s that helped shape that world. At the same time, I think its effects in the 60s were radically contrary to what we hoped they would be. And I think that's been sad, and it's very sad for me. It sort of broke my heart when I was writing the book, because of course I went into the book hoping to find the roots of something that I really loved. Let me say one note about the We Are All One moment. You know, we're used to that being a 70s moment. It's not actually a 70s moment. It's actually a 1948 moment. You know, 1948 is, and this is in my new book. I have a new book about the 40s and 50s, kind of a prequel to the old book and be coming out this fall. In that I talk about how 1948 is a moment when we imagine, we Americans imagine ourselves as global citizens in a way that's just dissolved from our memory since. You know, in 1948, a majority of Americans were willing to turn over control of the American armed forces to a world government. Think about that. A Gallup poll showed that most Americans were willing to turn over control of our armed forces. That's a vision of one world, of collaboration, of intimacy, that translates mystical intuitions of oneness into the potential for a real system, and that's pretty neat.
Yeah, well, I mean, now we're kind of we're bouncing around. I have a question about that moment too. I mean, I'm really, really drawn to the value in understanding how much the reaction to the horror of fascism in World War II set in motion a lot of the active invention of post-war culture, like, you know, quite consciously in opposition to what was seen as those social and cultural tendencies that could lead to fascism.
I think you've got your finger here on something really, really important. And this is where the counterculture and the cybernetic culture of military research come together and actually share an aim. You know, as people who grew up in the wake of the 60s or during the 60s, you know, we're so used to people telling us the story that the 60s were contrary to the 40s and 50s, that they tried to overthrow that era, that we can't recognize that actually both the 40s and 50s Cold War military establishment and the counterculture were deeply opposed to a hierarchical, bureaucratic, and ultimately fascist way of organizing everyday life. You know, we forget that during the late 1930s, you know, fascism was an active possibility not only in Europe, but here in the United States. 1939, as late as February 1939, 22,000 Americans rallied on behalf of fascism and gave the Nazi salute in Madison Square Garden. They marched unopposed through the streets of Manhattan, down 84th Street, carrying swastikas and American flags. There are pictures of this in Life magazine. We have totally forgotten that. We've forgotten the demagogues who ruled then. We've forgotten the possibility that, in fact, a hierarchical, vertically organized, top-down system threatened the world through Germany and also here at home in that period, and that many of our sort of circular, systematic, collaborative modes of being emerged both in research worlds and cultural worlds that were devoted explicitly to opposing and overthrowing that fascist vision of the world.
Yeah, and I always try to remember that when I'm too, you know, because you can get very, you know, very dark and very pessimistic about, say, the construction of consumer society and how consumer society creates all these unintended and sometimes intended effects, ecological effects. They have, they degrade consciousness and culture in many ways, et cetera, et cetera. But you can look back at the construction of just the idea of like having, of being driven by consumerism, by desire, by fantasy, by the sort of idea of improving through technology and cultural expressions your own experience and the experience of those around you. And you can, again, that's a kind of regime that, even if it has antecedents, is very much installed, promoted, conceived, described in this post-war moment. And so sometimes when I think about that stuff, I go, yeah, but it's probably that's probably still a little better than some of the other alternatives that could have come out of a world that, I mean, there's no way to know, but the out of a world that was more less inured to the totalitarian potential. The totalitarian societies are real, that they're real potentials, that we have them now, we have them inside of our own surveillance world, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's sort of a good kind of a way to balance some of the inherent ideas I think sometimes we have about the how negative the 50s were in the creation of...
Yeah, I really agree with that. And, I've come to think that, studying history is just basically studying irony one time after another. And, I think that one of the ironies that I see here is that the kind of system-oriented vision that we associate with cybernetics and that we retrospectively associate negatively with the idea of the system in the 50s, was invented very much in order to give people a chance to be in charge of their own lives and to have a kind of individuality that fascism seemed to deny. You go back to the 50s and you take a word like adjustment. Adjustment is a word that makes everybody nervous. If you tell me I should be focusing on my adjustment, I'm like, ugh. And yet in the 40s and 50s, the psychology of adjustment, the idea that a person could adjust oneself to one's own surroundings, stood precisely in opposition to the fascist idea that a person should be made into a member of a mass. And building systems within which people could find themselves and could act independently within boundaries that had been set for them by experts was something that went on across the 40s and 50s, something that cybernetic language, cybernetic rhetoric, cybernetic understandings of the world, and ultimately even the computer itself became a part of, were very powerful anti-fascist techniques. On the other hand, when we come to Vietnam, they become also tools through which we manage others in ways that are deeply pernicious. And I'm a little less sanguine about consumer society. I'd take it over fascism, but I do think that it takes away some of the forms of agency that we imagine we have. I think we live in a time where we imagine ourselves as being very, very free, but there are an awful lot of glass walls around us. And those glass walls were also built, ironically, in the effort to push back on fascism during the 40s and 50s.
Absolutely, yeah. It's more just about understanding how the, what was motivating the original builders of the cage we're in now. But we're going to take a break here. We're talking to Fred Turner, author of From Counterculture to Cyberculture, and a new book. What's the new book called, Fred?
The new book is called The Democratic Surround, Multimedia and American Liberalism from World War II to the Psychedelic 60s.
Okay, but it's not out yet, so you're just going to have to write it down for now. And anyway, we'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Fanny Mind. I'm Eric Davis here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking to Fred Turner, professor of communications at Stanford University, about the history of cyberculture, counterculture, and new modes of digital production. I this morning also had the chance to read fascinating piece, wonderful, wonderful, very clarifying piece you did on Google and Burning Man. In a way, you end your cyberculture book with the discussion of Wired magazine, which for someone of my generation, I wrote for Wired in some of those early years, was a very important signifier of this weird shift as like countercultural values and the freedom and hedonism associated with the personal computer and the internet got mixed up with like these conservative libertarian business ideas, and it was just such a bizarre artifact of these the multiple strands that go into the sort of what do you want to call it, the more progressive communalist side of the internet, the way we think about it, it's like a place of community and a connection and all of these things, and but it's all bound up with the business industry and the whole logic of global information capital, and it's just such a bizarre thing that Wired was this kind of almost feverish, like a fever dream of the connection between these various things, and one that was really trying to tell a very particular kind of story, and in a way, in a different way, but that Burning Man has a kind of in the flesh expression of the same kind of countercultural hipness or play or self-expression in the last couple of decades, and also makes these connections with technological industry, with new forms of capitalism. I'm kind of curious I know you went to Burning Man, when you first went to it, like how quickly were you able to kind of see through the garish, carnivalesque aspect of it and kind of go, this is actually not that different from the ways that people who work in Silicon Valley, which is your basic argument. I'd love to hear
right,
about.
Right. Well, I think what struck me first is that I went to Burning Man because I had encountered it first at Google. I was doing some visiting at Google, and I went into their main lobby on the Mountain View campus, and at that time, this is a number of years ago, there were a whole lobby's worth of pictures of Burning Man, shirtless fire spinners. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm in a corporate lobby, and I had just finished the counterculture book where all the computing worlds I looked at were things like IBM, where it was sort of blonde wood and wool and, secretaries and all of that. And suddenly I'm in this company where there's pictures of these fire spinners everywhere. I'm wondering, what is going on? And so I went out to Burning Man, and I was struck pretty quickly by something that has really come to stick with me, and it's the idea that Burning Man is to new media manufacturing, like Google, what the Protestant church was to mass manufacturing, like at Ford. And let me spell that out a little bit. So Max Weber, the sociologist, made his living showing how the social structure that emerged in the Protestant church literally mirrored and helped make sense of and legitimate the social structure that managed the everyday factory world. When you went to a Protestant church in, say, Cincinnati, the early part of the 20th century, the bosses sat up front. The workers sat or stood out back. The hierarchy of the factory manifested in the church. And by the same token, the spiritual legitimacy of the church gave folks a chance to rehearse and valorize the hierarchy that managed the factory.
Right, and also the values that you would need individually in order to be a productive worker.
Exactly.
The kind of way you organize your own sense of time. Well, I'm going to work now and be a devoted worker, so in the future I can reap the rewards of my long, fidelity to the corporation. And that, and you can see the same kinds of values being inculcated on a religious level as well. But it's very different with Burning Man.
Yeah, it is different with Burning Man, and Burning Man is really interesting. So I interviewed a whole group of engineers who go to Burning Man. I interviewed a lot of people. And one of the things I kept hearing was something like this: I get to do at Burning Man what I want to do at work but can't. And Burning Man is a place where you go and, you build a campsite together. You depend entirely on yourself and your friends. Collaboratively, you tend to make a work of art. It's often a technology-centered work of art. The art making actually goes on year-round in Silicon Valley. My neighbors have been building their Burning Man carriage all year. And these teams become a place where people can kind of collaborate, practice sort of engineering skills together with a deep intimacy, a deep collaborative intimacy, a sense of real control over their projects, and a sense of flexibility and mission-driven happiness. That's exactly what many of them are looking for at work, and that actually mimics the organization of engineering at Google. I had to wonder why a company like Google would spend as much energy as it does supporting Burning Man, and it does spend a lot of energy supporting Burning Man. In 1999, it virtually shut down so that everyone could go. Eric Schmidt was hired in part because he went to Burning Man. For the Googlers, I think, for the engineering side of Google, Burning Man is a kind of festive mirror of collaborative engineering practice. And it's a festive mirror that works at a kind of ideal level, the way that the church works at a kind of ideal level of the factory in Max Weber. It's a place where you can practice acting out the spiritual ideals of creative engineering, collaboration, future forward-looking work. It's also a place where you can build an individual reputation as a creative builder. And individual reputations are how you organize work inside a place like Google. It's not hierarchical. It's not a bureaucracy. I mean, there's hierarchy, but very little compared to what might have been at, say, Ford in the 50s. Instead, it's a place where teams of engineers cluster together, make stuff, and check out one another and see who's doing really good work, and then form a new collaborative and go do that work. And that's just exactly how Burning Man works as well.
Yeah, and that's, so there you have a perfect blend. It's almost like the two streams that you were identifying before, you know, meet again, where on the one hand you have a sort of artistic, bohemian, collaborative, environmental, you know, building situations rather than building, you know, discrete art objects, although there's,
right,
of course, a lot of discrete art objects as well, but they tend to have a situational or interactive character. And at the same time, the sort of, you know, grandchildren of those early research labs in World War II, except now, you know, designing items that increasingly blend, you know, kind of break down the distinction between, you know, functional technologies that help us live efficient lives and forms of media or expression or pleasure that have as much to do with entertainment or things that we think about it in terms of our more cultural lives, which is part of what makes the whole development of digital technology so weird, is that it's very targeted and resonant with many different aspects of our own psychologies, of our own desires. And, yep, you know, the link is so interesting now, but I flashed on something else, and this is not necessarily a dominant idea at Burning Man, but I think it's an undertone, and it's certainly in the aesthetics, and I think it's in the attitudes and even the sort of activist aspect of some of the people who do it, which is that another thing that Burning Man lets you do is that if on the one hand it creates the ideal form of the collaborative workplace, like here's a place where you, mm-hmm, can employ the same tools except to unquestionably positive ends, either for your own sense of creative satisfaction, your reputation, the fun of others, happiness, whatever you want to clarify. Not only does it have that ideal, but it is also a place where one can consider the far more apocalyptic scenario that the whole juggernaut of technological production is, you know, in a very dire straits, and that it's easy to imagine a kind of collapse. So that, mm-hmm, Burning Man also plays with a vision of a kind of exuberant collapse in a way that people who are in technology, even if they are disturbed by the same news reports and big picture sentiments as everyone else, cannot afford to do. That is not the way a corporation works, with very rare exceptions. You know, some people are going to make money off of disaster, but for the most part, especially a firm like Google, it's all about, you know, this is good stuff. We're going to keep building more good stuff, and maybe it's good stuff to help bad stuff not be quite so bad, but basically we're on a good ride. And you go out in Burning Man, it's like the same skills can also be seen as, you know, like the fundamental things that we will need in order to deal with situations that are far more drastic than the corporate media world wants us to recognize.
Yeah, I really agree with that, and I want to touch on a piece of that I think is really important, which is that, you know, Ellen Ullman, a programmer here who wrote a wonderful book called Close to the Machine, said that, you know, one of the ideologies she encountered in the workplace was that she should just be totally independent and individual. Said, yea, though I walk through the valley of death, I walk through on my own, carrying my own load. I'm an independent contractor, and I'm a free person. And I think that one of the apocalyptic pieces that you're picking up on there is not just an end-of-the-world apocalypse, but actually an apocalypse of the social contract that's already occurred.
Yeah.
I think that one of your things you're seeing out there is radical individualism, survivalist individualism, which is actually a pretty good mirror of the way that many folks in the Valley actually have to work. They really can depend only on themselves and their intimate, immediate networks.
Spoken as a canny sociologist. No, it's a beautiful idea, too. It flips it. You know, it takes the anxieties and the grind and the insecurity of living a freelance life in a digital context, and turns them into positive values, or at least imagines that it can turn them in to positive values.
Yeah, and in the short term, it turns them into a really great party. You know, I mean, it's a kind of this is where I think ecstasy comes in, and you've written a lot on ecstasy. I mean, not the drug, but the process, the feeling. I think one of the things that happens in an ecstatic moment is that you can feel both the acuteness of the suffering that you've had and transmute it into a kind of pleasure that is itself more acute because of the acuteness of the suffering. And when you do that together, then at least for that moment, you're not alone. Then at least for that moment, it all kind of makes sense and feels good. And what intrigues me here is the final ceremony, or well, not the final, but the next to last day at Burning Man, when, to my utter amazement, and in a way that I think would blow Max Weber's mind, a massive multi-story statue of the individual, the self, is lit on fire, burned, and thousands of people dance around it. Thousands of people dance around the flaming self. That just blows me away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's extraordinary also, and it's one of the things that I'm really coming to out of this conversation is this balance. It's not even balance, the polarity, the dance between not only our desires to have more deep experience of communal life, of being with others, of whether it's in a mystical context of a group mind or if it's new forms of collectivity that satisfy deeper aspects of us than are normally satisfied in our lives, but also the recognition that through our technologies we are actually building these sort of quasi-collective intelligence networks that we're participating in and that are also kind of, you know, enchaining us. Like we're on the ride to certain forms of collective intelligence, whether we want to be or not. So on the one hand, there's the sense of both the perils and possibilities of collective mind, and at the same time, you see this hyper intensification at Burning Man of at least a certain idea of what an individual is: their eccentricities, their idiosyncrasies, their capacity for unique creative interventions, for humor, for their own peculiar sexiness, like the extreme taken to 11. Vision of the individual as a singularity of desire and imagination. And I'm like, we want them both. We sense that they're both already actually happening, and yet it's really hard to imagine how they go together. And so and I think one of the things that makes Burning Man so attractive to so many people is that you kind of get both. I mean, there's nothing stopping your individual flourishing or self-realization or, you know, selfish pursuit of egoic satisfactions, and you're just sort of forced into forms of collectivity that resonate and draw you in whether or not you're even trying to make it happen. Now, is that applicable, inspirational, useful for other ways of being, thinking outside of Burning Man in terms of politics, in terms of new social movements,
I think you've got your finger on a really important tension, and I would take it back, as I seem to take everything back these days, to the 40s and 50s. And it's a tension actually between individual-centered, collaborative activity governed by cultural goods and more institutional forms of activity managed by technology but ultimately governed by hidden institutions. When you were talking about a group mind coming to life on the internet, I agree, but I want to really flag that group mind is not coming into being among freestanding individuals. It's coming to being in a way that's being managed, governed, regulated, interfered with at every level by institutions that are profit-seeking or in other ways seeking their own benefit. The internet is not a neutral place. And one of the things about Burning Man is that it feels like on the desert, right? When you're out on the playa, it's just flat. You're under the eye of God up in the sky. You're dancing together. It's a much more individualized place. But at the same time, even as it's very individualized, it's also governed by cultural norms. You know, there's very clearly a look that's appropriate at Burning Man and a set of looks that aren't. You know, when I did my first research out there, just on principle, I wore khaki pants and a white button-down shirt. I mean, people were offended. People would come up and tell me how just wrong that was and what was my problem. Why couldn't I get with the program? you know, that's a kind of classic way of organizing a social world when you don't have rules. You know, you just you have norms instead. You know, by contrast, on the internet, we're getting more and more rules. We may have a group mind, we may have experiences of intimacy that we're seeking, but we also have them within terms that are set for us by algorithms, which are in turn set for us by corporations, which in turn are operating within profit schemes and legal schemes entirely invisible to us. And I just think we have to be really alert to the tension between our individual self-formation work and both the power of collaborative spaces that are governed by cultural norms and institutions to shape that work.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes to mind. I mean, remember, we're living in the Bay Area in the 1990s. The first time that I kind of, I knew a lot of hipster programmer, virtual reality technology people, and went to Burning Man with them in 1995. I mean, they were some of the first technologists who were self-consciously identified as, like, you know, cyberpunk, we're making the tools for the future, we're psychedelic virtual reality people. So that was all like a sort of ethos that I picked up just through these social encounters. And then the first time that I went to one of their workplaces and realized how much, you know, back then even, that the workplace was changing its, not just its hierarchical or you know, its organizational principles and moving away from hierarchy, but even just the aesthetic, the vibe. There's beanbags, there's frisbees, there's
right.
You know, coconut juice, there, you know, that kind of sort of creature comfort, and that fusion of work and life experience that is increasingly characterizes you know, our business, our ways of working, our ways of moving through the world. And it's such a, you know, looking at that stuff, you're faced right away with like this fundamental polarity. Like, on the one hand, hey, that looks cool, that's a better place to work, it's more fun, you're going to work anyway, might as well have it be a place that's more fun and creative, right? Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously there's this, you know, aching, you know, suspicious despair that is precisely in the incorporation of a richer life world into the corporate space that we even deepen our, however you want to figure it, alienation, sense of loss,
right.
And of insubstantialness in our own selves, and yet that process, that kind of, you know, activity just disintensified. I mean, Google is like rules the world, and it's, that's what it is. That's what the game
yeah.
is.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's a really characteristic emotional experience of our time, certainly among folks like us, which is the experience of being drawn toward a more creative, flexible workplace precisely because we're longing for a kind of intimate community space in which life and work can be linked. And then finding precisely that it's not that, and that's hard, and that's a true countercultural legacy. You know, the dream of the communes was precisely for people to live in a place where they could be their whole selves at all times. They could be who they were in every dimension, even as they were at work or at play. And that dream, I think, is something that's available as a kind of cultural resource for Google. But there's another piece, though, that I really want to flag both for Google and for the new communalist part of the counterculture, and that's the politics of race and class. You know, class more than race, actually. You know, the world of coconut juice and, you know, bean bags is not the world of all Google employees. There are thousands of people who work at Google who work in call centers in the most regimented conditions. The cooks and kitchen workers at Google who serve those fabulous meals, you know, make very low salaries and have very limited childcare options. Those are folks that are right there, and they're not included in this kind of collaborative mode of working. And that was true in the counterculture on the communes as well. You know, the communes were predominantly white, predominantly college-educated or could be college-educated, predominantly middle and upper-class kids who went and settled lands as if they were uninhabited. So they go out to Taos, New Mexico, or they go out to Colorado, the High Plains, and when they tell their stories to themselves of what they're doing, as you go back and read the documents, you see it, they tell the stories of themselves as discoverers of a new land and adventurers in consciousness and builders of new communities, much the kind of story you hear around Google about what Google's doing now. What they don't tell you is that they're parachuting down into places that have been occupied by Mexican Americans and Native Americans for hundreds and sometimes thousands of years, and that they're bringing with them an entirely alien culture, and they don't really want to have much to do with the local culture. And that's a challenge in our own information era as well, this kind of collaborative, self-centered world that Burning Man celebrates and legitimates. is a world that's open to elites. Everybody's welcome here as long as they're the right kind of people. And
go ahead.
No, I just said that's a scary vision. That's a vision that's perilously close to the redlining of the 50s.
Yeah, that in some ways you can look at it as just an extension of educational systems, because in some ways the kinds of communities, the kind of collaborative space, the kind of sense of creativity, but with focus and drive that you get in a place like Google among engineers or whatever, is really just an extension of certain ways of organizing education. And you know, we see this harsh divide in terms of the opportunities and the kinds of whether from the sorts of technologies that are available or the sorts of ideas for people from the get go. And it's mm-hmm. really like that increasingly wide divide that characterizes the United States like a lot of other developed countries is you can just see it reflected even in the very sense of what world do you live in? What is mm-hmm. your world? You know, mm-hmm. is this world yours or is it not yours? Do I, you know, in the sense of being empowered to be able to interact with that world? And so I guess my question is, you know, it's always sort of dangerous to get like, you know, what value can we extract? What's the best attitude? Because, of course, it's always mixed. It's always confusing. We're always, you know, sort of like cybernetically sort of probing and taking in signals and revising our map, and it's always on the fly. But have you come to believe that it's important for us to take an increasingly skeptical and resistant view of the way in which particularly information capital weaves us in as users and as workers into this kind of world of creative expression under certain institutional requirements? Do you see that as something that it's actually kind of time to become more critical and more adamant?
So I do see it that way, and I see it that way in two dimensions. One dimension is I think very much in the way that you just described it. You know, I teach a course here called Digital Media and Society that works very hard at kind of exposing the political economy of digital media. And I think in that space, you know, I very much want our students and users in general to be literate in the ways, in the many ways that institutions and powerful forces are shaping our ostensibly individualized and independent experience online. And through that literacy, you know, begin to develop tools perhaps to challenge that distribution of power. There's a second level issue that I've come to think a lot about in the wake of the 60s, and I haven't really got a good language for it, and it's not quite as tied to the internet, but it still sort of is. And I want to say what I think that is. I think something that I've seen in the counterculture and, again, in some elements of internet culture is a tremendous embrace of people like ourselves, you know, that is people going out and finding others like them and building cultures around that. And I actually think that the great challenge facing our country is one of, you know, turning toward folks who are not like us, folks who are different from us, folks who hold views that are reprehensible to us, and trying to figure out how we can collaborate and get along. I think collaboration is really easy if you're collaborating among people who already share cultural styles and norms and who can lean on those as they come together to do things. I think collaboration is really, really hard when you have to work with folks who are very different than you are. And that's, I think, the challenge that nobody's talking about right now. And we need to get our arms around it.
Yeah, I really hear that a lot. I mean, this is a slightly random thought, but recently I've been thinking about the problem of how people can feel connected with other people who are really in distant places. And, you know, what kind of concept or set of practices can we have that allow us to not just fantasize that we have some connection with the, you know, 80-year-old Syrian woman who's in some camp in Jordan,
right,
or whatever it is. It's not just because we're watching it on TV. It's not because we're looking at it in the news. I'm like, well, where would it sit? And it's, for me, it has to sit somewhere in, like, somewhere between our bodies and the fundamental processes that we go through as social creatures: birth, death, you know, love, loss, these kind of mm-hmm. basic things that are much, like the more basic, the better. The more simple, the better. It's something about becoming very sophisticated and attentive to the most basic and ordinary things. That it's in that zone that there are, that it's easier to connect with people who are in a very different
culture. I really, really, really agree with that. And so my very first book many years ago was a book about how Americans remember the Vietnam War. And I spent several years working with traumatized combat vets who were some of the nicest men I'd ever known, and yet who had universally, in the group I was working with, done extremely violent things. And when I talked to them about how they had come to do such violent things, they invariably told me stories about how their ability to recognize other people as like themselves had been destroyed systematically, first in their military training and then on the battlefield. And so what I think makes for the possibility of collaboration across difference that you're pointing to so rightly are what I think of as structures of empathy. You know, these are ways of turning our attention precisely to the things that you were just pointing to the everyday, to our body and your body, to the sharedness. You know, when we go to consciousness and systems levels visions, it gets abstract in a way that makes it hard to appreciate the kind of quiddity of the other person. I think that is where we need to turn our attention. And to the extent that we can preserve our empathy for one another, that's what gives us grounds for collaboration.
Yeah, I really hear that. I mean, the empathy as a media, you know, empathy as an active channel. It's really interesting. I mean, that's a whole other topic. I'd love to have, you know, do a whole other show on just thinking and talking around empathy. And I think it sort of lurks on the edges of a lot of things. And it has to do with some of those same drives towards, you know, large collectivities and those kinds of more abstract ideas. But it's rooted, I think, in a different way. Well, we're going to have to wind it up here. I wanted to give you the opportunity to tell people about where they could find more of your writing or some of the other projects that you're involved.
Well, thank you. So I have a website where all my writing, all my short-form writing is, and where you can also find my books. It's http://FredTurner, one word, FredTurner, .stanford.edu, fredturner.stanford.edu. You'll find my writings there, and I'd be delighted to hear from you.
Yeah, that's great. And your book will be out in the fall. I'm sure I'll learn even more because it's a zone I know less about than
yep. The Democratic Surround. It will be out in the fall.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Fred.
Good. Thank you, Eric. Really appreciate it.
All right. From all of us here at PRN to you out there, keep your minds open.